Hello and welcome to History Hack. We're going in-house today because we've got a really cool episode for you and a fabulous guest who you may have heard of. Alex, who have we got with us?
If you haven't, then you've either been asleep for the whole of lockdown or you're an idiot, because we have with us Andy Locke, who is frequently on History Hack, especially down the pub. Lockie, as he is known colloquially when we're all a bit drunk, is a World War One historian, PhD student, battlefield guide, tour guide in London, basically educator extraordinaire. I think we should get that put on a t-shirt. What do you reckon, Lockie?
Oh, that sounds nice. Yeah, big t-shirt, please. Nice to be here, sober, I guess.
and actually talking about history instead of dicking around. This is weird.
I know, right? And nice history as well. This is close to my heart stuff.
Fully in your wheelhouse today, because today is the 9th of April, so we are going to commemorate the battle that makes Lockie tick, basically, because it's the basis of a lot of the work he's doing, and it will become very quickly clear while there's a Canadian hanging around in the room. He's expecting to be the centre of attention throughout this. Lockie, start us at the beginning. Concept. Why is there an offensive at Arras in April 1917?
Okay, so it's moving things on after the Somme, essentially. People will know, if they know two battles in the First World War, the Somme will be one, and then the Third Ypres campaign, or the Passchendaele campaign, will be the other one. This one kind of sits in between the two, and I guess it's the product of a man with a plan, first of all, a French man, with a plan, but also kind of the British Army needing to get on the front foot again and not waste all the build up of force and everything that they learnt on the Somme. They wanted to get stuck into things straight away in spring of 1917. So Arras became it.
You mentioned the Frenchman with a plan. Who was the Frenchman with the plan?
Nivelle. Well, yeah, here's the thing. He comes out of the Verdun side of things. Because, we got the British bashing away alongside the French on the Somme. Concurrently, you've got the French in this slogathon all the way through 1916 at Verdun. Initially, it doesn't go well for them, but in the second half of 1916, they really start pushing back against the Germans. And one man whose kind of background was an artillery commander, Robert Nivelle, rose to prominence. Using some fairly thick artillery fire and creeping barrages to drive the Germans back out of their gains in the first half of the year. He's a fairly charismatic guy, actually, Nivelle. People liked him, including the British Prime Minister at the end of 1916, beginning of 1917. I think Nivelle kind of seduces Lloyd George a little bit.
It definitely shows a bit of leg.
Yeah, I'm sure Lloyd George is not easily seduced by a bit of leg, is he?
Scandalous.
Anywho, yeah. So Nivelle essentially says, right, got it, nailed it, cracked it. I know how to beat the Germans. Here's what we're going to do. What I want is a big British attack somewhere, let's say around about the join of the Wotan line and the Siegfried line, somewhere like that. Oh, Arras. There it is. There's also a bit of a logistics base there. Good to work from. Plus there's some nice kind of tactical objectives, which would be good to take around there. If the British launch a big attack around there, that'll really interest the Germans. That'll drag a load of Germans over off into that area. So they're not defending the French sector quite so strongly. And then pow, 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 three big strong French attacks are going to punch through. And in 48 hours, Nivelle's offensive can break through German lines, and then we're on the road to victory. I'd stake my reputation on it, says Nivelle. And if we don't break through in 48 hours, you can bin me, sack me, call off the offensive, do what you like.
And hilariously, if you're sitting out there and you're thinking, this sounds like a good idea, you're an idiot, but there were many idiots in the French government that bought it.
Well, they were. I mean, it's the kind of success at Verdun that gives him the credibility, I guess. Plus, the way the Somme turned into just a bash fest with no clear gains meant that they're looking for someone to kind of take over from Joffre, who had been at the head of the French army previously.
He definitely told him what he wanted to hear, didn't he? But I mean, we could waffle on about Neville and his madness and the flaws in his plan that are revealed wholesale when the French do their part of the attack for two episodes in itself. We could do a two-part special, but we're not here today. You definitely wanted to talk about the British side of things, didn't you? So the British attack at Arras is based on occupying the Germans and distracting the Germans before Nivelle starts. That's essentially why it exists. But tell us, how did they start planning for it?
Okay, so there's a huge amount of planning. I mean, essentially, if you think about all the things that went wrong on the opening day of the Somme offensive, where the artillery fire isn't thick enough, isn't accurate enough, they don't pay enough attention to counter-battery fire, which is where they shoot at the enemy's artillery. And that's crucial because, you know, it depends on the battle a little bit, but artillery is the big killer in the war. You know, it'll account for somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of all battlefield casualties. So this counter-battery role is crucial. They've made big developments in, firstly, finding enemy artillery using new techniques, and these get sort of chatted about quite a lot in the books, you know, sound ranging and flash spotting, the idea that you can spot a flash of a gun and then use kind of microphones to pick up the reports, the sounds of the guns firing, the shell moving through the air, and then the impact of it. And you can calculate where these guns are. They got pretty sick at that, actually, the BEF, by April of 1917, to the point where they identified around about 85% of German gun batteries and could put all of those under fire. There were improvements in infantry fighting through the Somme offensive as well. Just generally more light machine guns, getting better with those light machine guns. Better use of mortars. So the support weapons for the infantry, they're getting more adept at using them, and they're becoming more numerous on the battlefield as well. The BEF's doing a decent job of thinning the battlefield out a little bit as well, not just all charging off in big waves, you know, with an officer with a stick shouting, "Come on, chaps, follow me," like they may have done in 1915. And it's actually more the NCOs taking them forward. They're more experienced from what they've been doing the previous year as well. And so there's a general skill level raise across all branches of the British Army.
There's also the cadre system, isn't it? That now they leave a section of men at the back so that they don't completely destroy a unit.
Yeah, you don't have total pulverization. That works in theory on this one occasion at Arras when it didn't. And actually, I think the Newfoundland regiment on the 14th of April, I think they were left with just about their battalion HQ. And that's really about it after one attack. So it's not perfect. Again, as we will explore. But, I mean, the planning is immense. They're also, in terms of artillery techniques, they're using things like a creeping barrage as a kind of standard method of fighting. And that's a barrage which drops first on the German outpost lines, potentially, and covers their front lines, and then advances steadily forward with the infantry behind it. One of the problems with the first day of the Somme was that they dropped the bombardment on the German first line, and then the infantry moved in, the artillery picked up and shelled the second lines, but there's too much of a gap between the lifting of the artillery and the infantry hitting it up, enough time for the Germans to get their machine guns out. That wouldn't happen. The infantry would be close up behind this barrage, which crept forward steadily, and that was standard procedure. Plus, the number of guns they had was pretty stunning, and not just number of guns. I mean, for again, I keep comparing it with the Somme, but it's just sort of interesting from that point of view of progress. If they've got 1,500 guns firing on the opening day of the Somme offensive, well, this time they've ramped it up to about 2,200, but the main difference is the number of heavy guns, all right? If they've got 400 or so heavy guns, that's like a 6-inch caliber or higher, 400 or so firing for the Somme, you know, for Arras, they've got about 950, and that's a big, big difference in firepower.
What's the length of the front as well?
It's a little bit less for Arras. So, you know, it's a more concentrated bombardment anyway, even without the increase in firepower. So all of this is pretty good. They're fighting against German 6th Army, led by a man called von Falkenhausen. whose name I promise I haven't just made up as just a German sounding name. It is a real person. They weren't terrible, but they hadn't really kind of moved with the times in terms of where German defensive doctrine was going either, which is kind of thin out the front lines and actually hold the bulk of your strength in reserve. So when this immense British artillery bombardment gets going, they've got too many men too far forward, and they suffer very heavily from this artillery bombardment.
Just on the bombardment, I remember reading a long time ago in Bereson's book about Bimmy that they actually looked at what each gun would fire so that you wouldn't have too many guns falling short. Is that true? Did they start looking at what each gun could do scientifically, or was it just a standard, right, everybody shoot over there sort of thing?
No. It very much is. You've got the starting the process of, and by the end of 1917, they've really got this down to a dark art, looking at the level of wear on the gun and atmospheric conditions. At this stage, they still had to fire pre-ranging shots. Okay, which is the sense that, you know, you've got artillery observers with binoculars, and it'll be boom, no, you're too far left, come right a bit, boom, no, that's too far over, boom, no, you've shot over the top, boom, no, you've dropped short, and after a bit of firing, you get it right. The trouble is, you kind of lose the element of surprise with that, and you know, if you're the German and you've seen a shell drop to your left and drop to your right and drop behind you and drop in front of you, you think, oh, not sure I want to be here anymore. Let's move the important stuff out of the way. But just the sheer weight of fire meant that surprise wasn't that much of an issue with that opening stage. I mean, it's actually quite a logical place to attack Arras and Vimy, because you've got that objective of Vimy Ridge, which the French had fought very hard for in 1915, for example, taking it but losing it again. But you've also got the join of the main kind of German defensive lines that they'd built through the second half of 1916 and early part of 1917, what we call the Hindenburg line, really. But actually, the Germans had a number of names for the different parts of it. So it's a logical place to attack. Surprise isn't really a factor, but that weight of bombardment, the planning of it, is going to override that. And actually, it did.
Right. Then the Germans throw a massive spanner in the works, don't they, by retreating to the Hindenburg line, beginning at the end of February.
Okay, yeah, so that's it. This scuppered Nivelle's plans more than it scuppered the British, to be honest, because it's only really on the kind of southern part of the Arras battlefield where actually there's any kind of withdrawal. But essentially, where the French had planned to attack, well, yeah, it starts in February on the kind of Somme front, where they pull back to their kind of next defensive lines, and that sort of sets the British at least going, oh, hang on a minute, what are they up to? Are they gonna pull back to these lines that we've photographed and seen being built? And then in mid-March, that's when they start making their big withdrawal across a huge front. Essentially, there was a big bulge in the lines that the Germans had captured in 1914. Really, that the British and French offences hadn't been able to push them out of. Well, the Germans pulled back themselves to shorten their line, free up a load of divisions, and set themselves up and around this epic set of defensives with a load of concrete, tons of incredibly thick barbed wire, and effectively said, come us.
I'm just going to throw in a reasonably noob question, which isn't on the list, and that's the concrete question.
The Germans were down the bunker porn aficionados.
It's just that thing that you get asked a lot is, why were the German trenches concrete and ours made of mud? That,
because they didn't want to go anywhere and we did.
Yeah, it kind of is that, really. What the fighting of 1916, I guess particularly the latter part of 1916 had kind of highlighted, was if the Allies want to pulverize a trench line, they can. Okay, that's kind of what we have with the 14th of July Bazentin Ridge. attack, for example, where the British concentrate their artillery firepower, blast this trench line out, and are able to advance. Okay, that's what the British can do in July. So what the Germans are going to do is make a lot more use of concreted strong points. Okay, they don't concrete the entire trench because that'd be just too much. It's too much in the way of resources put into it, but actually kind of strong point defence. And, you know, concreted bunkers become a lot more prevalent. And I guess we think of it at least as much in Flanders as we do in France, where if you do a tour around the kind of Passchendaele battlefield, you'll see the kind of almost like the cottage style of bunker. These are raised above the ground because of the way the ground works in, in Flanders, is very sort of prone to flooding. Whereas, you know, in the Hindenburg line, you're talking about deep mined bunkers that don't necessarily need to be concreted out because they're down underground. Now, this needs a whole new style of infantry fighting to counter it. It also means that there's more protection for the Germans. They're fighting a defensive battle at this stage. I mean, the British and French do work on their trenches. They don't like living in total hovels. But the way it works is, especially for the British, they're much better at kind of cycling the units out of the trenches, particularly the frontline trenches. They're not in there for more than sort of a couple of days at a time, so they're not getting comfy in the same way that the Germans are. Also, the Germans aren't on the offensive at this time, so they don't need the amount of concrete, etc., in there. Right, does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. I'm just dragging you guys back from your deep dive World War One stuff that just leaves all the rest of us terribly behind. Right. So the question I was supposed to ask really was, let's talk about the 9th of April itself. Why does it work? Because this, on this day, it is actually a success, which is one of those rare beautiful things.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to take sort of the British kind of front line and think about it topographically, start inventing words, you've got three British armies that are working on this. Maybe that's something that people need to know. The British army by this time is blooming big, split into five different armies, each under their own army commanders and each of those with their own personalities as well. The kind of northern end of the Arras battlefield is covered by First Army, a man called Henry Horn in charge of that, but actually it's got one corps of his attacking, and that's the Canadian Corps under Julian Byng. They do have a brigade from British 5th Division on their north flank as well, but it's really the Canadian Corps' show, Vimy Ridge. And if we kind of also draw a kind of success chart, it's kind of the most success at the northern end of the battlefield, and then it kind of steadily kind of tails away to on the southern end of the battlefield where you've got 7 Corps. They do make some gains, but it's quite hard work down there. Up on Vimy Ridge, I want to say they've got most of an army's worth of artillery firing on a corps front, and that's quite stunning. Vimy Ridge is actually a really difficult place for the Germans to defend in the style that they're moving on to, which is kind of a lightly held front and then kind of the main strength held back. Because Vimy Ridge, if you kind of look at it from the British or Canadian perspective, it slopes up really quite gently to a point where it absolutely drops off. It's almost like a cliff edge facing towards the east, and then pancake flat ground beyond it. So where the Germans would want to kind of retreat and then counterattack, they can't do it because they've got this massive great cliff. So basically they have to hold the entire ridge in strength, which means those units get pounded by artillery. Those that survive, it's fight to the death stuff against the Canadians when their four divisions come over the top. And it's not a pushover at all, Vimy Ridge. There are dedicated Germans who do sell their lives incredibly dearly. But the Canadians by this stage are no mugs either. So some hard fighting. And actually they clear most of the ridge on that first day, the 9th of April. And in the days that follow, they get the rest of it done. And that's a serious achievement worthy of a big memorial. And so that's where the big Canadian memorial is on the western
front. Happy now, Boney.
Yeah, it's I remember the shock of walking up it and then suddenly the hill's not there anymore and it just drops straight away and you're looking out over miles and miles and miles of France. So It's a very interesting place with a very lovely memorial on the top of it. I'm happy we've got a mention. You can move on. It's just growing up in Canada. You'd think that was the only thing, really, because that's our foundation story. That's where so many people say Canada starts.
Well, it's the first time all the provinces fight together, isn't it?
Yeah, you got all four divisions fighting side by side, and that's the kind of significance of it, really.
And then the Newfoundlanders, who like to remind you they weren't part of Canada at that time, but yeah.
That always hammers your word count, I found, right in books, when you have to explain that at every turn.
Well, we'll get to the Newfies in a bit if we've got time, because they were at the Arras battlefield. They're only on the Western Front in battalion strength. Slightly understrength battalion. It's not very populous, actually, at this time, Newfoundland, and I don't think that's changed a great deal.
And it doesn't help they get practically wiped out twice in a year.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about Canada and Newfoundland.
This has been great, thanks. I'm off.
Tell us, though, is it equally as successful for the British?
It's even better, actually, in stages.
I didn't want to hear that.
the next corps, you know, from the kind of southern end of Vimy Ridge, the next corps down is Charles Ferguson's 17 Corps. And he's got some, I want to say, some famous units in line. He's got the 51st Highland Division working with him. They're a pretty big deal. 34th Division we tend not to shout about, but, you know, they're competent, certainly. 9th and 4th Division, what they do is attempt this kind of leapfrog manoeuvre, which has never been done. It's been done with, like, smaller units, but you've got 9th Scottish Division who bust through the German 1st and 2nd trench systems, go up to the 3rd system, and then 4th Division leapfrog through 9th Division and press on right the way through. They end up gaining 3.5 miles. It's the biggest gain since trench warfare started. They capture the village of Fompu and the big kind of redoubt just up the top of the hill there, the Hyderabad Redoubt or the Polenwerk, as the Germans called it. And that's the kind of high water mark, I say, for the 9th of April. It's a really, really big gain. You then got the river, which kind of separates them from the next corps down, the River Scarpe, which, if you imagine it sort of wiggling off through the battlefield, it kind of does almost like a quick right and then left at this point. But 6th Corps get on all right again. They don't make quite the same gains. They don't have any leapfrogging or anything like that, and they find resistance a bit stickier. There's also some of the staff work goes a bit all wry, and some of the troops lose their creeping barrage as well. So things get a little bit stuck. And then 7 Corps, further south still, they've got a hell of a task in places, because they've had to close up for the Hindenburg line. So they're attacking the Hindenburg line. They've got a hill in front of them called Telegraph Hill. And that's 14th Division, by the way. That's our guys that we're looking at for the Great War Group. This hill was a pain in the neck, quite frankly. I think they had to do some pretty serious maths and work out whether this creeping barrage was actually going to take the heads off the soldiers as they went over Telegraph Hill. And I think they worked out that the shells had probably missed them by a few feet or so, but it's been pretty close. anyway, they end up getting a little bit stuck around the kind of top of the very northern edge of the Hindenburg line, where there's another redoubt called the Harp. And so it's not quite as easy, but on the whole, it's really, really good. You know, as far as it's a kind of day to celebrate in the war goes, then the 9th of April for the British is a really strong one, and it's not quite matched probably until the 8th of August 1918, I would say.
So if you take a pause here, if you were to ask Allenby, for instance, how he's feeling on the 10th and 11th, he's in a good place, isn't he? He's happy. He's doing a bit of a strut.
Certainly on the 10th, yeah, he wrote a letter to his wife saying, we've had a very big battle, we've had some huge gains, thousands of Germans taken prisoner, dozens of guns as well, and it really was. They probably captured around about 7,000 prisoners on that opening day. Like I said, gained 3.5 miles. He did take a point to write to his wife and say that their son was safe as well, because their 19-year-old boy was actually a gunner as well. He's an artillery officer firing as well, but you know, he was okay. And so there's nothing to complain about at that stage. On the 10th, things slow down significantly. And on the 11th, you probably got the last bit of genuinely good news when Sixth Corps, kind of in the middle of the battlefield, just south of the river, actually captured the village of Monchy-le-Preux, which is a real kind of strategically important site, actually, because it overlooked the Arras-Cambrai road, and any kind of advance out of that area would need the village of Monchy under their control. So it's good stuff. Yeah.
And then this is World War One, so it doesn't stay good for long, does it? The wheels start coming off. You've got four key reasons why, but tell us how as well. What went wrong?
Okay, so this idea that they could just move up through the gears was wrong. Very, very wrong indeed, because essentially, if you think back to what the original plan was, what was the original plan? It was to draw German reserves into the area.
It took a long time as well. It took a long time to arrange said plan.
Yeah, it had. That's another big point. Like, essentially, they've taken the time to make this incredibly detailed plan, map out the artillery and get all that stuff sorted. It worked. Brilliant. You know, but it took months. So any kind of, right, you're facing a whole new defensive line. The Germans are steaming reinforcements in. You know, we're talking dozens of trains loaded with fresh soldiers, fresh artillery. They're arriving hourly into the battlefield. Also arriving into the area is probably their best defensive commander, Friedrich von Lossberg, who essentially takes von Falkenhausen and says, you remember when I explained those plans to you about, you know, how we kind of defend a sort of light zone and then we have the kind of main strength held in the rear? Are you actually going to do that now? And von Falkenhausen says, yes, I'll do that now. And so their techniques get sorted out. Fresh troops come in, and the British are necessarily weaker than they had been when they started. You know, they've taken some casualties, nothing like the First July and the Somme, of course, but they have taken some, and they've been fighting for a few days, and, you know, efforts to bring the cavalry through failed. As well, I mean, really, the kind of some of the commanders in 4th and 9th Division, where they made those big gains and got up to the German 5th line, were screaming for the cavalry. Then, you know, it has to be, what's Maxwell's quote? Yeah, cavalry. Yeah, 1,000 times yes, but it has to be now. Okay, they spent the whole 10th waiting for the cavalry to turn up. Eventually, on the 11th, it's, oh, the cavalry are here now. Well, great. But, you know, these villages in front of us are now full of Germans with machine guns. So it is too late. They did have a crack on the 11th with cavalry to the north of Monchy. When it was captured, they tried to break through to the north between the village and the river. Trouble is they were observed, came under a lot of shell fire. Some cavalry swerved off to the left and ran off. Some cavalry swerved right and actually into the village, whereupon the Germans dropped this god almighty box barrage on Monchy, and the effect, particularly on the horses, was horrific. And so you've got horrible, horrible images of dead horses in the streets of Monchy and you know, the gutters running with the blood of these horses. A real, real horror show, because it was too slow. The time had passed for the cavalry. And so, new plans needed. They pressed on. The 14th is when they canned it, is when Haig said no more offensive action. And what you have is one kind of final dart out with elements of 29th Division. And this is the Newfoundlanders. So it's day five of the offensive, really. In front of Monchy, to the east, was a hill called Infantry Hill. And they thought these two battalions will have a poke at it. First Essex and the Newfoundland regiment will have a go at trying to capture it. And they totally fell victim to that German style of defence, lightly held in the front, and then a big counterattack unit which came and slammed these two battalions and wiped them out. And so that's the wheels off. Now, Haig didn't want a complete stop, but they had to halt it at that point. A couple of days after that, Haig got the army commanders together, Horn, Gough, and and Allenby, and said, look, the French are attacking today, which they were. We need to start making plans to drive on. And I've got a feeling these three army commanders probably looked at each other and thought, hey, we've done our job. It's up to the French now. Yeah, remember, punch, punch, punch. So we're going to launch those three attacks, which break through the German lines. Yeah, we're going to make plans to attack as well. Let's get ready to go on the 20th. Okay, so that leaves these army commanders with 3 days to plan the next attack. Horn immediately starts saying, whoa, I'm not ready. No. Gough says, I'm not really interested in this until Third Army's nailed some of the high ground to my left. I don't want to start, charging towards the Hindenburg line again. His Fifth Army had a go at the Hindenburg line on the 11th at Bullecourt, and we can do a whole other podcast on that, or three podcasts on that, because that's a whole other show.
Even I've heard of that one.
Yeah. And essentially they break in to the Hindenburg line, but the Australian 4th Division, that is, has the door shut on them from behind, and so they lose a load of guys. So Gough's not keen until, Third Army have done some of the stuff to his left. And Third Army has a lot to do, according to Haig's plan. They end up postponing to the 23rd. But it's still not a lot of time to make proper plans.
I mean, they had months to get ready the first time, didn't they?
But they did. They had not just months to make their plans, but months to get all their guns into position. Yeah. What they're faced with now is, because of all that heavy artillery, they've smashed all the roads up around Arras, and now they're being asked to get their guns forward into position to support a new attack a few miles ahead. It's just too hard. They can't get the weight of artillery. And don't forget, the Germans are getting stronger by the day. Facing them, and they end up kind of with stronger German defences by the later stages of April than they had for the 9th before the attack went in. So there's too much facing them, really. On the 23rd, it's not a total disaster. I mean, you do have 63rd Division up in the north. They capture Gavrel, which is all right, but 17th Corps at Ruhr. This is the battle I did my master's thesis on, because it's just attack after attack after attack, where they get absolutely nowhere against, there's dozens of German machine guns firing. It's a horrible battlefield to try and attack. You've got a railway embankment, which then turns into a railway cutting as it moves through Greenland Hill. You've got wooded areas. You've got a village kind of split across the foot of the hill there, which then drops down into the river valley as well. So you've got dead ground. It's all under observation. The first crack at it they had on the 11th was disastrous, and 2nd Seaforth Highlanders were cut to pieces. You got probably the grimmest feature that I've ever seen on a trench map as a result of that attack. It says line of dead Seaforths actually on the trench map as a kind of identifying feature. But it's scarcely any better on the 23rd of April. Further off down the south, they do make some inroads into the Hindenburg line, but they make no serious progress. The tanks that they'd had for the earlier stages, a few of them were still running, but Arras isn't, I want to say, a high point for the tank, really. It's they have a few that have isolated moments of success, but actually there's a lot of breakdowns. There's a lot of instances where the Germans are using armor-piercing bullets as well. So it's not friendly tank country at all. So the 23rd of April, no serious joy. And then 5 days later, they go again. By this time, it's become clear that Nivelle's offensive really isn't working. If the French had stopped attacking, as they had kind of said they would, then this attack on the 28th wouldn't have gone in at Arras either. But the fact that, Nivelle had said, look, we're persevering with this, the French government's behind it, the men are behind it, by the way, they weren't, the attack on the 28th wouldn't have happened. And it's really no good. Okay, it's mostly the northern part of the battlefield that they attack. The Canadians are back in action, actually. And so Canadian 1st Division captures Arleux, at the northern end of the battlefield. And really, that's the only piece of good news. That battle on the 28th of April is consequently known as the Battle of Arleux. A few instances where second division got to Oppy. There's a couple of little break-ins, but they're not tenable. And it's a story of tired men going up against strong defences at this point. And I'd love to say that was the end of the battle, but it wasn't.
Just out of interest, what is the depth of the advance? How far did they get?
Are we talking on one of these occasions?
Just sort of from day one on the ninth through to where we are now. How far have they gone?
There's hardly any. When we get to the kind of when Haig takes his eye off Arras altogether after the 3rd of May, that's when you get local commanders actually thinking, right, what do I need to do to capture, to improve my tactical situation? Okay, and there's a little bit of an advance from that. But actually, from kind of, the 11th of April and the capture of Monchy, which is an advance of, about 3.5-4 miles or so, there's scarcely any. Down in the south, where the gains have been smaller earlier on, they do expand on those gains a little bit. But, we're talking a mile or two, and we're not talking huge, huge gains. So really, that high watermark of sort of 3.5 to 4 miles doesn't really get expanded on in the fighting that follows.
You've mentioned the 3rd of May. It's not a good day, is it?
It's really bad. I think this is...
that you've said to me before, this might be the worst day on the Western Front?
Yeah. It's not. In terms of sheer casualties, it doesn't eclipse the first day on the Somme. Doesn't quite get close to it, really. It's actually quite difficult to know precisely how many casualties, because all these units report their casualties differently. But we're probably talking about 20,000 or so British casualties. It's more the point that they should have known better. It's a total balls up from start to finish in terms of planning. And it's really rare that you get errors on this scale made by the BEF, okay? And I say that, I'm fully aware of some pretty howling errors, but, by the middle of 1917, we should be doing a whole lot better. Firstly, he's still got his three army commanders. Haig, essentially, is focused on Flanders at this time. He wants to transfer the full attacking weight further north to the area around Ypres, where he kind of always wanted to be fighting anyway. And his deal with Nivelle was that, after Arras, we're going north. To this end, he couldn't really give the generals around Arras any fresh divisions. Okay, he did end up giving them a couple. 18th Division comes into the line and one or two others. But 18th Division is probably the highest rated British division around this time. And so... yeah, what gets wrong? You've got three commanders, each with very different grounds in front of them. You've got Gough with, aside from a railway embankment, which he's going to have to cross anyway, he's got pancake flat ground in front of him, in front of the Hindenburg line. He needs to attack in darkness. If he attacks in daylight, his troops will be minced. Okay. Further north, on 1st and 3rd Army's front, they've got a whole load of broken ground. It's what I was talking about just then with the kind of hills and the railway embankment and the railway cutting and the river and the wooded areas and villages, all heavily fortified. You need daylight to cross these. And so trying to find a start time for this offensive. Now, kind of logic would dictate you don't have one uniform start time. You can send some off in the darkness and some off in the light. Hey, didn't want that. He wanted a uniform start time. So you got Gough going loggerheads with Allenby and Horn, who, each want daylight or darkness, depending on what works for them. They end up going with a compromise time, which suits absolutely no one. Sunrise, proper sunrise, how technical do you want? 5:22 a.m. is proper sunrise. But actually, the first crack of lights is just after 4 o'clock. All right, so you can start seeing people about 4:05, and that's what 1st and 3rd Armies wanted. The first hint of daylight, so they can actually see where they're going, that's when they go. 5th Army wanted 3:30. Okay, they wanted pitch black for at least half an hour so that they could get stuck in. They went with 3:45. Okay, now, why is that bad? Well, firstly, when 1st and 3rd Army set off, they can't see anything. So they've got 20 minutes or so of bimbling around in the dark, presumably with the Germans knowing that something's up and able to do something about it. As it happens, the Germans had seen the preparation anyway and so knew that something was up. So even before the attack went in, the British front line was deluged with high explosive and poison gas. Okay, and this just breaks everything up, causes total confusion. confusion. To make matters worse, the moon was doing a thing as well. The moon was setting just behind the British lines. So while they were forming up in no man's land, they're perfectly silhouetted by the moonlight. The Germans are in the total darkness. The Germans can see all these soldiers forming up in front of them. They knew they were coming anyway. And so they're then hammered with machine gun small arms fire on top of the artillery, which is already dropping on them anyway. It's total disaster. There's, and even these fresh units that come in actually do make a little bit of ground in the face of all of this. So 18th Division do get into Cherizy, but then, you know, in the confusion, someone reportedly shouted out, "Retire." And so there's a whole load of falling back before officers grab them and said, you know, no one actually said retire. It could have been a German shouting retire, which then the men heard. Further north, again, the Canadians do make some ground. They've fairly recently reinforced the Canadian Corps. So a brigade each from 1st and 2nd Canadian Divisions capture the village of Frenois. And that's all the good news. Really, it's just miserable. 4th Division are already weakened, but they take 2,000 casualties and get absolutely nowhere. So elements of 9th Division in the darkness, they were supposed to execute this kind of right wheel maneuver, but they wheeled too far. And so when a bit of daylight appeared in front of them, they see a trench line, they open fire on it and start advancing towards it. It's the British front line. it's a total calamity from start to finish, the 3rd of May. And it's awful. And for that reason,
does do the Western Front, isn't it?
Yeah, it could hardly have gone worse, genuinely. But that's when Haig decides enough's enough as far as he's concerned. He orders no more major offensives. And actually, kind of with the army commanders going quiet as well, the local commander, the divisional commanders and the corps commanders get to look at their little bits of front and say, look, what can we do to improve our tactical position? And actually, there's some quite skilled attacks that go in after that. So 4th Division, which took 2,000 casualties on the 3rd of May, a week or so later, launches this attack on Ruhr. And it's good. Like, there's lots to like about it. Firstly, you know, they do things like cut cubby holes in the trenches so they can just stash men, basically. They hide them away at night. They bring a whole load of extra Lewis guns into the line just in case an enemy plane does fly over. They can give them the good news. They arrange a barrage with the division the other side of the river as well, 12th Division. And this time, 12th Division is going to use a load of smoke on their front. So, bah, 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 bah. They fire off a load of artillery, drop a bombardment. There's no infantry attack there, but in the smoke, that's where the Germans think the attack's coming. So the artillery bombardment that the Germans drop is over there. They ignore the 4th Division. They attacked in the evening as well, which was unexpected, and also, you know, cut out the German opportunity for counterattacks. They do lots right when the kind of army commanders leave them alone. So these are small gains, and this is sticking plaster for what had turned into a real nightmare. Success on the first day, success in the first few days.
Hang on a second, Lockie, let me go back because I'll ask you for the net result. So, Lockie, what is the net result of the Arras offensives?
Okay, so first thing to say is it worked. You know, their plan to draw Germans in, they achieved their objectives in that. However, when they tried to restart this offensive, we ended up with the highest rate of death per day of any British offensive. And that includes the Somme, it includes Passchendaele. The only one that kind of gets anywhere near it really is the 100 Days offensive, the end of the war. But we end up with over 4,000 casualties a day at Arras. These kind of efforts to restart on quite a large level. If you think about what kind of like the middle stages of the Somme or, you know, kind of fighting in August where it's like small scale penny packet attacks. One thing about that is the casualties aren't epic. Okay. Whereas if you try and load up a big kind of 7 or 8 division attack in just a few days, send them out, you can end up with 12,000-15,000 casualties in a day and gaining absolutely nothing. And that's what we had in those later stages at Arras. So about 145,000 casualties in the course of a 39-day offensive. It's pretty epic.
What about the Germans, Lockie?
German losses not as high. You won't be shocked to hear. Again, quite difficult to know exactly, but I think it's around about 80,000 they take. And they do lose quite a few in their counterattacks, but also going through the cages. There's about 20,000 or so prisoners taken, mostly in those early stages, of course. But it's an attack which... It showed progress, showed some of the progress that the British had made, but it also exposed some failings. Yes, okay, they could plan a big offensive action, one that would smash up a German defensive line. Didn't really matter what the Germans put in front of this. Given enough time and enough artillery, the British can smash it to bits. Okay, so in that sense, it's an interesting battle because it sets us another step down the road to restoring movement to the battlefield. You know, the Germans are going to hold a position in strength. The British can batter it to bits and capture it. It's a question of what they then do about German counterattacks and things like that. The logical step is you move to something like what Second Army did in September of 1917 when they go for their bite and hold, quite small advances designed to draw the Germans into costly counterattacks. So it's a step on the road to that as well.
So let's get back to our friend Nivelle. Why is this whole strategy pointless? Is the basis for my nation's pride actually a complete waste of time?
No, it's not a waste of time at all. I don't think this is the most impressive Canadian fighting on the Western Front, actually. Yeah, I think if you look at their actions in 1918, these are stunning.
Yeah.
But it's a big moment. Certainly, you know, getting them together, and it ends up with, you know, Byng, the corps commander, ends up getting promoted to take on Third Army because Nivelle gets canned. You won't be surprised to hear, but also kind of Third Army, British Third Army's commander Allenby, who masterminded the offensive and then rather lost control of it. He was canned as well and actually did all right in the Middle East later on. That's another podcast too.
So there's a lot to return quite a lot of times.
Gareth.
Lucky does get, a series on World War One.
Get Tanguy Gareth in for Palestine. He likes it there. So there's plenty to be proud of from all of these units. I think, you know, all of these units kind of have their moments in this attack. So 4th and 9th Division individually do well at different times. The Canadians consistently seem to do well. I mean, that the last village that they captured, Frenois, was actually lost then by a British division, 5th Division, which is a shame. But, you know, more heavy fighting kind of followed. 12th Division end up being kind of one of the kind of benchmark units for tactical progress. 18th Division... Maybe they're never quite the same again after their Somme fighting and losing Maxey as a commander, but they still perform creditably as well. So there's a lot of loss, but there's a lot of creditable fighting. The French attacks, again, if we kind of compare them to the Somme the previous year, they're not too bad. Trouble is, for the French, this was not the first major assault as it kind of was on that scale for the BEF in 1916. They'd been fighting hard 1914, 1915, 1916, and now 1917, each year with the promise of, on les aura, we'll get them this time, and each time not quite doing it. And so I can imagine after 4 years of this, or into the fourth year of it, French soldiers being fed up, and they proved it by mutinying on a large scale, not in the sense that, you know, they stabbed their officers and went off home, but they said, do you know what, we're just a bit sick of charging off out of our trenches to get shot again, you know.
You don't even feed us properly.
Exactly, yeah, we want a bit of food, a bit of leave, and we'd like someone who kind of thinks about us a little bit instead of just thinking about their own personal glory and what they have to gain from us.
And they got it as well. They did get that as 1917 went on, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And it's by July, they're able to sort of get on the front foot again and launch some limited offensives. They did take part in the Third Ypres campaign as well, the French. And by 1918, they have a few horror stories on the defensive, but actually the kind of main impetus for the counterattack, which turns into the 100 Days Offensive. That's a French thing, the second Marne. So they come good as well.
That's utterly fascinating. For me to understand the sort of wider context of it, because we have a very narrow viewpoint when it comes to this battle in Canada. It's that first day, it's that big victory. It's us waving a flag that we don't have anymore. And that's very reassuring to know that, you know, we didn't do this thing alone. There was this sort of grand effort with the British to achieve as much as they did, because it is a big success during a period when there wasn't a hell of a lot to write home about. So we thank you very much, Lockie. You're welcome back anytime. Well, to be fair,
in a few hours, possibly.
You can be back in a few hours as well. So thank you very much for joining us, Alex. It's always a pleasure to share a show with you.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack, and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.